on some of the core issues to the with regard to the state, I feel up to speed. You can always learn more, and I'm anxious to do so.
Governor Palin picks a new attorney general. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 16th of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a vet in Sitka spells out the inherent danger of a delicate bear operation.
It's the lack of adequate anesthesia, in which case the bear will be eating Dr. Thornton.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Alaska Governor Sarah Palin has named a new state attorney general. Palin was at a Soldotna Chamber of Commerce luncheon for the announcement today. KDLL's Ben Stanton was there and has this report.
Kenai Peninsula legislators spoke briefly before Palin hinted there was a big announcement to make. She then introduced Dan Sullivan as her choice for attorney general, making sure to clarify which Dan Sullivan she was speaking about.
And it's now with great pleasure here on the peninsula that I announce our nominee for AG. That's Dan Sullivan. No, not that Dan Sullivan. As much as I like our new mayor of Anchorage, Daniel S. Sullivan, I'm going to invite him up to say a few words.
Sullivan graduated from Harvard and Georgetown and spent time as an active duty Marine and in the Marine Reserves. In the aftermath of September 11 terrorist attacks, Sullivan desired a larger role in government and became director of the National Security Council and National Economic Council at the White House. In 2006, President Bush selected Sullivan to be Assistant Secretary of State for Economic, Energy, and Business Affairs and served as senior advisor. Palin added that Sullivan has family and business roots in Alaska.
He has a strong Alaska legal background and public service record in the state. His leadership in negotiating achievements at the highest levels of the U.S. government, including on issues of vital importance to all of us, to everyone in the state of Alaska, will help ensure that the interests of Alaska and our citizens are advanced and are safeguarded.
Sullivan spoke about what he calls Alaska's challenges and opportunities. Sullivan explained in broad terms his expected focus. That includes ensuring safety and protection of Alaska citizens through consumer protection and reducing crime, ensuring economic opportunities, getting gas to market and producing energy, defending an appropriate balance of federal and state rights, and as AG, working in a management role.
As an Alaskan lawyer, Marine, diplomat, I am ready and eager to use whatever skills and tools are appropriate and necessary to help our state achieve success in all of these areas.
After the luncheon, Sullivan said he'll be meeting with the leadership team at the Department of Law and with commissioners to get up to speed on the more specific issues facing the state.
On some of the core issues, Arctic policy, law of the sea, some of the core economic issues, I was very focused on those issues in my prior job. So on some of the core issues to the with regard to the state, I feel up to speed. You can always learn more, and I'm anxious to do so.
In particular, Sullivan cites his experience with the U.S. State Department, where he worked on global energy issues, and some of the people he would interact with as Alaska Attorney General. Sullivan would not speculate on his chances for getting confirmation by the state legislature. The state's previous attorney general resigned in the wake of the Troopergate scandal. Palin's original pick to succeed him was Wayne Anthony Ross, who was voted down by lawmakers who didn't like his controversial remarks. In Soldotna, I'm Ben Stanton.
In selecting Sullivan, Governor Palin picked someone who has not made headlines in the state, but U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski has known Sullivan for about 10 years and has been impressed with his work in the nation's capital. She says his intelligence and ability will not be wasted in Alaska.
I know because I have talked with Dan. I know his passion for Alaska. I know his desire as a public servant, because that's what he's been doing, whether it was with the military or working with his past administration. There has been a level of service to our country, and I think he's now committed to giving a level of service to the state.
House Judiciary Chairman Jay Ramros gives the governor an A-plus for the choice.
I've met Dan before. I grew up with his wife, Julie Fate. He is an elegant man with a blue-chip reputation who is just going to be a consummate professional.
Hollis French, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, met Sullivan at a meeting at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He says he was impressed with Sullivan's intelligence and his close connection to the state. One of the few potential drawbacks mentioned in regard to Sullivan's appointment is his recent absence from Alaska. French doesn't see that as a problem.
You know, I'm sure during the confirmation process we'll find out whether, you know, he's been able to get himself fully up to speed on Alaskan legal issues. And, you know, frankly, from a glance through at his resume and his academic history, I'd be surprised if he hadn't. You know, he comes with a broad array of public service that, you know, looks very good.
In an introductory letter to all members of the legislature today, Sullivan did not talk about recent friction between the executive and legislative branches. He said among the responsibilities of the Attorney General is to work with lawmakers, and he said he takes that role seriously, looking forward to understanding the issues they face. A federal judge is requiring the U.S. Forest Service swear by affidavit that it has released all of the documents related to the disciplinary action it took against a whistleblower employee on the Tongass. Marquita Eath asked for the documents about her late husband, Glenn, under the Freedom of Information Act. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein has this update.
In a June 12th ruling, U.S. District Court Judge John Sedgwick ordered that the Forest Service certify by affidavit that it has fulfilled Marquita Eath's FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, request for documents related to her late husband, Glenn. Glenn Eath was a Forest Service biologist on the Petersburg Ranger District with over 22 years of service. According to agency documents, he had fully successful performance ratings. He became a whistleblower employee in 2006 when he successfully challenged some of the Forest Service's road construction work for a timber sale. Subsequently, Eath's superiors on the Tongass transferred him to a different job and had him investigated. They ultimately accused him of misconduct, proposed firing him, and put him on administrative leave for nearly 8 months. They never issued a decision on the misconduct allegations. Instead, the Forest Service eventually told Eath his job was being eliminated due to budget cuts. Eath believed his employers were retaliating against him for being a whistleblower. The agency has consistently denied this. Federal law prohibits reprisals against whistleblower employees. Eath died of sudden heart failure in his sleep in March 2008. Marquita Eath originally wrote to the Forest Service that May to request the documents about her husband. The agency provided hundreds of pages but withheld hundreds more, claiming some were protected from disclosure by attorney-client privilege while others were protected as part of the agency's internal deliberations. Eath filed a lawsuit in the fall to get the Forest Service to give up the rest of the paperwork about her husband. The agency eventually released more documents this winter and spring. They included emails showing that the Forest Service's own legal counsel in Washington, D.C., disagreed with efforts to fire Eath. The lawyers worried some of the action the agency had already taken could lead to reprisal claims. There were also emails in which another agency staffer told colleagues to destroy messages related to the case because they might become public if the issue went to court. In the Freedom of Information case that's currently in court, Marquita Eath motioned that the agency certify in a sworn affidavit that it's provided all of the documents she requested about her husband. According to recent court filings, the Forest Service opposed her motion, claiming that its search for documents was adequate and that it has produced the documents she requested. But in the June 12th order, Judge Sedgwick cited the Forest Service's previous resistance to Eath's FOIA request, and he wrote that he was not persuaded by the agency's unsworn statement that it produced all the documents she asked for. Sedgwick concluded that the Forest Service must provide an affidavit that includes a relatively detailed description of the document search and an affirmation that the agency has produced all the documents that's required to release and listed all the documents that it still claims are privileged. The judge also ruled that the agency must pay reasonable fees for Eath's attorney. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a six-year-old hooks a big fish in Homer.
She did get kind of traumatized when they had to shoot it to get it in the boat. She was not happy about them having to do that.
I started crying.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org. And by the UAF College of Engineering and Mines, providing early registration for fall engineering classes at 1-877-474-7390. Information at uaf.edu/cem.
A company exploring for minerals on state land off the Denali Highway mistakenly drilled on federal land. A drill crew working for Toronto-based Pure Nickel strayed south across the highway onto Bureau of Land Management property June 10th. Local environmental advocate Ruth McHenry and her husband discovered the helicopter-supported drilling operation while out hiking.
And because of where the helicopter had originated from, we realized that there had to be a drill rig right over this little hump. And I started thinking about it and thought, that's not state land.
McHenry, who runs the local environmental group Copper Country Alliance, says she reported the incident to the BLM, which subsequently took action. BLM Glen Allen Field Office spokeswoman Marnie Graham says the drilling operation was shut down.
We asked the company to cease and desist, and they have pulled their equipment, and they're rehabilitating the site. They were very cooperative, very, very apologetic on everyone's part. It was an oversight.
Graham says there was only minimal damage to the environment and Pure Nickel is required to reclaim all drill sites. No fines were issued. The hole was sunk on land in line for transfer to the state on which Pure Nickel already holds claims. Pure Nickel CEO Dave McPherson says the company didn't realize additional permitting was needed.
While we had state permits and permits to handle water, et cetera, we had inadvertently overlooked getting a federal permit. So once we found out about that, we immediately shut our drill down and had it moved off site and reclaimed the spot.
McPherson says drill holes are only about 6 inches in diameter and the fly-in exploration site is barely detectable on the landscape. Copper Country Alliance's Ruth McHenry says the mistake confirms her concerns about a lack of state oversight.
As far as the state, as far as DNR goes, no, it didn't shake my face at all because I didn't have a lot of faith. I knew that they're always short on field inspections.
McHenry's group actively opposes development of a mine in the wildlife-rich area that's popular with hunters and hikers. The Department of Natural Resources says exploration companies generally do a good job self-regulating, and what happened with Pure Nickel is rare. Southern Southeast residents relying on sleeping pills at night and coffee to make it through their days have a new tool at their disposal. Ketchikan General Hospital is opening a new sleep center that will specialize in diagnosing sleep-related disorders. From member station KRBD, Deanna Garrison reports.
The National Sleep Foundation estimates that some 20% of Americans sleep fewer than 6 hours a day. That's less than 7 to 9 hours of shut-eye, the foundation recommends. Residents struggling to meet those sleep guidelines may soon be referred by their physicians to the Ketchikan General Hospital Sleep Center. Angela Futrell is the Sleep Center Coordinator for KGH. She says the center, which will be located within the main hospital campus, is a two-bed lab that will be operated 3 nights a week.
The rooms are really very comfortable. They're beautiful, like a nice hotel room. We do videotape during the procedure, but the only people who see that is the person scoring the study and one of the doctors.
Dr. Calvin Lamb, a sleep specialist with Ketchikan General Hospital, says patients would be referred to the center by their general physicians. After an initial consultation, patients found to be at risk for sleep-related disorders would be asked to undergo a sleep study. During the study, Lamb says patients spend the night at the center so they can be monitored throughout the sleep cycle.
We monitor the brain waves. We monitor the breathing, we monitor the heart, we monitor the leg movements, oxygen, many, many monitoring in terms of obtaining the information so that we can look back after the patient have completed the study. Think of it like going to sleep in a hotel type of thing, but with a lot of wires on the patient with video as well as audio recording.
Lam says electrodes connected to the patient help clinic staff determine the amount of time spent in each stage of sleep.
In general, when people are awake, they have different patterns that we can recognize and see on the brain waves, and then we'll see disruption of sleep as we monitor throughout.
Petrol says extra care is taken to ensure patients are comfortable during their overnight stay.
The procedure is absolutely painless, and the technologist always makes sure that the patient is absolutely comfortable in their surroundings and during the procedure.
Lam says many struggling with sleep-related disorders often don't seek medical help despite far-reaching consequences.
Sleep disorders, those affect people's quality of life, affect their work, affect their relationship and social function as well. So it's quite important for us to readdress the issues when it comes up.
Lam says there are a number of seemingly harmless symptoms associated with sleep disorders.
Snoring, for example, is a risk factor for obstructive sleep apnea, such a symptom of feeling sleepiness during the day, for example, as well feeling fatigue or unrefreshing sleep despite what seemingly adequate amount of sleep a person go through. And people who say, for example, if they say, you know, I'm not feeling refreshed when I wake up and I'm tired and I need to take naps during the days, those are the type of symptoms that you want to look at it. Other things include family history. People who have sleep disorder diagnosed in their family also at increased risk for certain type of sleep disorder.
Ketchikan General Hospital hopes to open its new sleep center at the end of this month. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/copper river. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
Palmer residents Charles and Courtney Humphrey, along with their three kids, came to Homer on Sunday to try halibut fishing for the first time. Call it beginner's luck, perhaps, but six-year-old Tegan Humphrey ended in the top spot as Lady Angler in the Homer Jackpot Halibut Derby. She caught a 138-pound halibut with a little bit of help.
It was hard to pull it in because my dad started helping me, and we needed hope.
The huge fish was more than three times Tegan's weight and 40 pounds more than the 98-pound halibut caught by the previous top lady angler. Tegan sat high on her dad's shoulders when she wrote her name on the leaderboard. She and her parents described their experience of landing the fish.
It was pretty tough trying to get it reeled in, and I'm a little girl sitting there telling me, "Real faster, Daddy, real faster."
it
was pretty nice to reel in a big one like that.
However, she did get kind of traumatized when they had to shoot it to get it in the boat. She was not happy about them having to do that.
I started crying.
The whole family enjoyed their trip with Big Bear halibut charters, and everyone limited out. Courtney says she and Tegan rescued one halibut from a dangerous situation.
Right before she had caught the really large one, she was reeling in one, and all of a sudden the line tore off and started pulling out of the reel, and me and her were fighting it quite a bit. And once we got it up, it was only a 10-pound fish, and I was shocked because it was tiny. But once we got it on the boat, we looked, and there were teeth marks all the way down. Apparently, a huge fish had bit it and was trying to take off with it while we did so. We apparently saved that fish's life that day.
The Humphreys left Homer Monday afternoon with a carload of freshly processed halibut, which Tegan says she really likes to eat. Once upon a time, there was a thriving shrimp fishery in Kodiak, but after a long decline, it disappeared altogether in the mid-1980s. And while the potential for the reemergence of the fishery someday exists, predicting it is challenging. KMXT's Eric Wander has more.
Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Shellfish Area Management biologist Nick Sigalkin said that most of what he knows about the shrimp fishery in Kodiak comes from old ADF&G reports. He said the fishery began in the late 1950s and grew to substantial proportions.
You know, tens of millions of pounds, probably averaging 10 to 12 million pounds. At one point in time, the earthquake and tsunami had an effect because of the damage to the plants. I think the peak harvest was slightly over 80 million pounds in the 1970 or 1971, and it slowly declined after that.
Al Birch fished shrimp with his brother Oral beginning in 1959 in Seward. The two came to Kodiak to fish crab after the 1964 earthquake severely disrupted the shrimp fishery in Seward. Once in Kodiak, they soon began fishing shrimp again. Birch recalled the early days when the shrimp fishery was at its peak.
Shrimp was just really going gangbusters right about then. You had tremendous, tremendous amounts of shrimp. In 30 minutes from the time we threw the winches in gear, we could put 40,000 pounds on deck and have the nets back on the bottom. Just revolutionized the fisheries, you know, just really sped things up.
Sigalkin said the gradual decline continued through the early 1980s and that by the middle of the decade, the fishery was essentially finished. He said there are two thoughts about exactly why shrimp disappeared and that they bear striking similarity to the situation with red king crab.
Our exploitation rates, they may have been higher than what we'd recommend in current times. The other thing is that the Gulf goes between these cold and warm climatic regimes. You may have heard of a climatic regime shift or these oscillations.
Birch remembers the decline of the shrimp fishery well, but he said that with it came other opportunity.
77, we had a decadal shift. The temperatures just drastically changed. Our nets would come up just plugged with this green slime. We brought some of it into ADF&G here, and it was a green filament algae. It would absolutely plug the nets, and they said, well, that's a sign that something's changing. The water's getting warmer, and boy, it did. And it was immediately decline in shrimp and crab both. Really wiped it out. But it brought the finfish in. You know, the halibut really started growing. The biomass of halibut went up. The cod, just amazing amount of cod showed up. Pollock, flatfish.
Asked about the likelihood of a shrimp fishery reemerging in Kodiak, Sigalkin said it's difficult to forecast, but that anything's possible given certain environmental conditions.
If and when the Gulf does enter a cold regime, and there is some indication that we're experiencing that now, and so you would expect to see some improved survival of shrimp and crab communities, that we would start to see these populations build from their low levels to some of the population highs that we saw in the past.
Shrimp were once so important in Kodiak that the city's official seal includes one, along with a king crab and a brown bear. Sigalkin said shrimp fisheries are few and far between in Alaska these days, with one in Southeast, which is mainly a pot fishery, and a small limited trawl fishery in Prince William Sound. I'm Eric Wander.
A pair of orphaned brown bear cubs captured 2 years ago have settled into their new home at an exhibit in Sitka called Fortress of the Bear. With a steady year-round diet, the cubs have grown large for their age. Both are somewhere between 300 and 400 pounds, and they could easily be mistaken for four-year-olds. This summer offered an opportunity to neuter the brothers before they reach sexual maturity. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
All right, everybody, think back to their youth. Jack has castrated lions and tigers, now bears. Oh, my.
No fewer than five veterinarians are attending this morning's castration of Shaik, a 2.5-year-old grizzly bear well on his way to 400 pounds. Most are here to help, some to watch, but only one man will actually perform the procedure.
Jack Thornton, I'm a veterinarian from Sequim, Washington, actually halfway between Sequim and Port Angeles, Washington.
Did you lose any sleep last night over anything that's going to happen today?
I always lose sleep over what might happen.
Thornton went to veterinary school at Washington State University with a local Sitka vet, Burgess Bowder. Having died in a diving accident, been resuscitated, and decompressed, Bowder is a master of gallows humor. A grizzly bear castration is his world series.
It's anesthesia first, and number two, is not the hemorrhage. It's the lack of adequate anesthesia, in which case the bear will be eating Dr. Thornton, who's had a good life, who's reproduced, consequently will not qualify for a Darwin Award.
We're waiting outside the fortress, which is housed in a decommissioned concrete clarifier tank of the former Alaska Pulp Corporation mill. There's a veterinary dental team here from Fairbanks as well. Inside, Shaik is being separated from his brother, Kiliznu, and lured into an adjacent holding pen where he has been conditioned to come and lick maple syrup off the bars. A state game biologist has darted Shaik with anesthetic, a risky procedure under any conditions. Fortress manager Les Kinnear gives us an update.
Gave him a 3cc, a 4cc dart. So that's 1,200 milligrams. It might be a little light, but we're going to see how he does, and then we can hand inject if we need to for additional.
Is there a suitably marked exit? You have that sign on now.
Moments later, an intern gives us a signal, and the vets move in. In a pool of light in the otherwise dark enclosure, Thornton kneels between the grizzly's legs and makes an incision in order to reach up into the inguinal canal to the undescended testicles. Bowder has knee pads on as if he was laying flooring. He scrambles quickly in and out of the pen to get local anesthetic and suture.
Mamby pamby. I should have brought number two. I got number two. I use in dogs, for God's sake.
The vets are working like men in a house on fire. Shaik is lightly anesthetized. His jaws are wrapped, but he's moving his head a little. In about 15 minutes, their work is done, and people begin to move equipment out of Shaik's pen as fast as it came in. Shaik is sleeping this one off. The veterinarians were most anxious about the anesthesia, and they're clearly pleased that they pulled off this job with the absolute minimum. Fortress Bear manager Christine Fenwick sits just outside the bars where she had earlier spread maple syrup to draw in the patient. She orchestrated today's procedure and is well aware of the risks, both for the bear and for the project, if this had not gone well.
Now you could have a whole variety of intact males living together,
really?
And they'll be fine. Mm-hmm. As soon as you put a female in there, though, then there's a problem. So because they're responding to her hormonal cues, so what otherwise would be very gentle, loving males all living together would turn on each other as soon as a female was introduced into the area, even if she was fixed. So it does help with management of them, and they behave less aggressively towards each other in a situation where a female might be around.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
See you tomorrow. Same time?
Same time tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ben Stanton in Soldotna, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Marshall Lynn in Homer, Eric Wander in Kodiak, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.